and it is within 2.5 miles of the top of the World Highway.
Crews attack at least 2 more wildfires in interior Alaska with hotter, windier weather on the way. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, black seaweed is a delicacy in southeast Alaska, but it's getting harder to find healthy plants to harvest.
I was alarmed and very, very, very upset. I had no clue what was going on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
The Lost Horse Creek fire north of Fairbanks has continued to advance, but Fire Information Officer Cale Casey says it's not in direct line with a Haystack subdivision neighborhood for which an evacuation notice was issued Wednesday night. Casey says crews worked the blaze yesterday from the air with water and retardant drops and on the ground with bulldozers. He says structure protection equipment was expected to be deployed today.
The Haystack subdivision structure protection plan is completely in place from 2021, meaning all the parts and pieces are on order and arriving and will be put into the exact locations where they need to be. There's no discovery process with Haystack because it has seen so much fire activity over the years.
Casey says the objective is to get as much work done as possible prior to predicted higher temperatures and winds this weekend. He says more crews and equipment are being brought in to battle the Lost Horse Creek fire as an Alaska-based Type 2 management team took over command of the incident and other blazes north of Fairbanks today. Casey asks the public not to use drones in the fire area as they present a hazard to firefighting aircraft. There's also a new wildfire in the Anderson complex south of Fairbanks. Fire Information Officer Jeff Lysik says the pilot spot fire is 2.5 miles southeast of the confluence of the Nenana and Teklanika rivers. Lysik says that a fire, last estimated to be about 94 acres, was hit with water and retardant drops, and a group of firefighters was deployed along the park's highway and to the city of Nenana to begin planning structure protection.
Looking around to see if there was anything that they might need to do to either protect Nenana or the structures along the highway if that pilot spot fire moves in that direction.
Lysik says the Anderson complex continues to bring in more people, and as of late yesterday, there were over 220 working the incident. And crews responded to yet another new wildfire yesterday near the Alaska-Canada border. Alaska Fire Service Information Officer Al Nash says the new start is located about 4.5 miles northwest of the Poker Creek border station.
And it is within 2.5 miles of the top of the World Highway.
Nash says 8 smoke jumpers jumped the fire late yesterday. An Indiana man has pleaded guilty to soliciting the 2019 murder of an Anchorage woman in what prosecutors described as a catfishing scheme. 25-year-old Darren Schillmiller used the name Tyler online and promised a group of teenagers millions of dollars to record themselves killing 19-year-old Cynthia Hoffman near Thunderbird Falls north of Anchorage. Schillmiller and one of the then teens, Denali Bremer, have both also pleaded guilty to federal child pornography charges. Bremer, who pleaded guilty to the state murder charges in February, is set for sentencing later this month. Schillmiller's sentencing is scheduled for January. A California man who was indicted last month on federal sexual abuse charges had a decades-long association with Juneau's Echo Ranch Bible Camp. Bradley Earl Rieger volunteered at the camp as a nurse and counselor starting in the 1970s. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more, and a warning, this story contains mention of sexual violence toward minors.
The charging documents allege that Rieger abused more than a dozen boys and young men, often under the guise of medical care and often during camping trips or church activities. But federal investigators believe he could have hundreds of victims. In an interview, former Juneau resident Troy Wilson told KTOO that he's one of them. He says Rieger befriended Wilson at Echo Ranch when he was a child and first abused him during a trip to California.
he's a monster. And now that I hear about the things that he's done to other kids and other people, the stories are identical. And I hope that my story and statement helps those people someday.
Wilson may be a familiar name in Juneau. He worked for the Juneau Police Department for nearly 2 decades, left the force, and went to prison after shooting at police during a mental health crisis in 2012. Wilson said the standoff happened at a time when he was working to confront the trauma of Rieger's abuse. A federal grand jury in Sacramento indicted Rieger last month on charges of, quote, illicit sexual activity abroad, transportation of a minor with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, and coercion and enticement, unquote. Rieger lives in Susanville, California, where he's owned a series of medical service companies. According to the criminal complaint, Rieger would find ways to travel out of California on camping trips or church-affiliated missions with his victims. Then he would sexually abuse them under the guise of medical treatment. The complaint says that some of the abuse took place during camping trips in Alaska, though it's not clear where. Rieger pleaded not guilty to the charges on July 21st. Investigators are still looking for other possible victims who have not come forward yet. Rieger's presence in Juneau dates back to the 70s. In a statement, the parent organization of Echo Ranch Bible Camp, Avant Ministries, said Rieger was never employed by the camp, but volunteered in the 70s and sporadically over the years. A history of the camp, written for its 50th anniversary in 2014, includes several references to Rieger. Avant's statement says the organization is, quote, grieved by the reports about sexual abuse by Bradley Rieger and grieve for any and all children harmed, unquote. And it says Rieger can no longer be affiliated with Avant services or set foot on Avant property. Troy Wilson says he met Rieger when he was a child in the late 70s, and his parents worked at Echo Ranch. His parents trusted Rieger. So when Rieger invited Wilson, then 12, and two other boys to go to California, Wilson's parents said yes. They thought it was a chance to go on a fun road trip and go to amusement parks, which his parents couldn't afford to pay for themselves.
Now, looking back, you know, he was, I believe, was grooming my parents and grooming us kids.
It was on that trip that Rieger first assaulted Wilson, under the guise of checking for ticks, Wilson said. At that time, Wilson didn't understand what had happened to him.
As time went on, we went back to Echo Ranch. Nothing ever came up, never said anything.
Then, when Wilson was 18, he worked for and lived with Rieger for a year in Susanville. He saw it as an opportunity to get into a career in emergency medical services. When Wilson started suffering from severe back pain, Rieger offered to examine him. Instead, Wilson said, Rieger assaulted him again under the guise of medical attention.
He was a nurse. I trusted him. He was a friend. I was looking for help.
After the second assault, Wilson said he didn't feel like he could do anything about it and didn't report it to police. But other people did report Rieger. The criminal complaint says Rieger was investigated at least as early as 1986. It says that Susanville police investigations in 2003, 2006, and 2007 involving multiple victims did not result in criminal charges. Wilson stresses that Rieger did not abuse him at Echo Ranch, and he doesn't know if Rieger abused anyone else there either. Rather, Wilson said he thinks Rieger used places like the camp to befriend families and gain access to children.
That's what he does. Echo Ranch was a mechanism that introduced him to our family.
Wilson, who now lives in Washington State, said that after he served his prison sentence, he started going to therapy to deal with his trauma. He says that he hopes sharing his story might make it easier for other victims to come forward. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
And a quick note, in Juneau, survivors of sexual abuse can call AWARE at 907-586-1090 to find resources for support. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a baby walrus is settling into life at the Sea Life Center after being rescued from the North Slope.
He follows people around, and as soon as they sit down, he'll be laying up against them.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
A walrus calf was rescued from the North Slope this week and flown to the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. The center says the month-old male walrus is now receiving round-the-clock cuddling. Dr. Carrie Gertz, director of animal health at the Sea Life Center, says the 200-pound calf showed up with dehydration, malnutrition, and a cloudy eye, but is showing signs of improvement.
He is taking his bottle very well, so that makes it so much easier for us to take care of him.
Workers on the North Slope spotted the baby walrus in an odd location, on tundra about 4 miles inland from the Beaufort Sea. Pacific walrus don't normally venture so far from the coast. It's not clear whether he traveled under his own power, but Gertz says observers noticed a trail in the tundra that may have been made by a walrus near the road where he was discovered.
He's got all these little cuts over various parts of his body, which suggested him, going over some rough stuff.
Several organizations rallied to help the animal. With approval from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the calf was moved to a warehouse overnight. Then ConocoPhillips flew him to Seward Tuesday in a company plane. The Sea Life Center is now providing 24-hour care, including cuddling. Gertz says walruses are extremely tactile and always in contact with one another, so the staff are trying to stay close for his mental well-being.
It's obvious that is something that he seeks out and other calves seek out. And so we do provide him that companionship. And usually, he follows people around, and as soon as they sit down, he'll be laying up against them.
The rescued calf is only the 10th walrus ever admitted to the Sea Life Center in its 25-year history. Black seaweed is a culturally significant delicacy in Southeast Alaska, but in recent years, traditional harvesters say it doesn't look or taste right, and it's difficult to find. Now, a regional native nonprofit hopes a new study can help save the harvest. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
Irene Dundas has harvested black seaweed her whole life, near Cake when she was young and near Ketchikan as an adult. The harvest happens in May, when the seaweed is exactly the right size. Dundas and family members travel by boat to specific large rocks far from shore. It must be low tide so they can pull the seaweed off the rocks.
When you're grabbing it in your handful, it looks like you're grabbing a handful of long, thick black hair.
Black seaweed is found in more treacherous areas. It needs nutrients that only come from lots of moving water. Dundas harvests about 50 gallons to share with family and friends. Processing is lengthy, drying the seaweed into bite-sized pieces.
It kind of was crunchy, like a piece of popcorn, but the flavor is like the black seaweed that you put on sushi. It's that exact flavor.
She transfers the wet seaweed in pillowcases and puts it outside on several large tables to dry. But in the years 2021 and 2022, she noticed something was wrong.
The seaweed had a very, very distinct, strong smell. There was a discoloration, this light green color. I felt like it had a little bit more metallic taste to it.
To get any good seaweed this year, she traveled for hours by boat near the Canadian border. Her past harvests, she threw away.
I was alarmed and very, very, very upset. I had no clue what was going on.
This year, I hardly had anything of a harvest.
Keolani Booth collects black seaweed on the outer waters near Metlakatla and southern Prince of Wales Island.
I usually give out quite a bit to our community members that can't go out. And I was only able to get a minute amount, and it was kind of heartbreaking because, some of these people depend on me to bring them some seaweed for the year.
Booth says black seaweed could be like a canary in a coal mine, a warning of what could come from climate change.
It's a very hard seaweed to try to cultivate. It's very sensitive, which, you realize that in the open ocean, it's a precursor to all the things that are stronger in the ocean.
The Metlakatla tribe got a grant to start researching the problem 2 years ago. That research is ongoing, and last month, Dundas and Booth carried their concerns to a meeting in Juneau, hosted by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Harvesters and scientists discussed what to do. Jennifer Clark from Vancouver brought a Western science perspective. She works for a kelp company, but studied the effects of climate change on seaweed for her PhD. In a post-doctoral project, she worked with indigenous groups in central British Columbia about black seaweed disappearing there.
In 2016, it's almost completely missing from the intertidal shoreline.
Clark's research linked the disappearance to an enormous hot water mass in the northern Pacific known as the Blob. In 2014 and 2015, the Blob moved from the Gulf of Alaska down to California. It was followed by more heat from El Nino, which elevated seawater 1 to 2 degrees, enough to destroy the black seaweed.
These heat waves are just kind of unprecedented. They just cause disruptions in life cycles and disturbances in the intertidal, which most of the seaweeds that you find are intertidal subtidal. So they're getting extreme changes in their habitat.
She learned that black seaweed couldn't survive past 64 degrees. As temperatures cooled in the years after the Blob and El Nino double whammy, BC seaweed started to come back, but not like before. Clark doesn't know if Alaska's black seaweed problem was also affected by the Blob. She says it would take more research. But she does know that black seaweed anywhere has challenges ahead if climate predictions come true.
I think if it was persistent, like if we were to increase 2 degrees, 2050, I think that's the projection is 1.5 degrees, then maybe they won't be so resilient and they'll just kind of exist as much as they can until they're wiped out.
Black seaweed is, you know, really important to us as a food source, but also for its cultural components.
Rosita Worrell is the president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. She says the seaweed is critical to many communities in and out of Alaska because it's shared and traded.
It's like a glue that binds our community together through our widely sharing patterns. And then the other important thing, it also has spiritual dimensions. Black seaweed is distributed and consumed during our ceremonies.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is creating a committee comprised of harvesters and scientists to start studying the problem. They're also documenting the historical practices of the harvest and how it's changed in recent years. They hope the information will help them figure out if there's any way to save black seaweed. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A team of scientists set out for the Yukon River Wednesday to find out more about a trove of dinosaur tracks discovered along the banks a decade ago. KYUK's Emily Schwing caught up with the team in Fairbanks and will be traveling along with them for the nearly 3-week expedition.
For almost a quarter century, Tony Fiorillo has studied dinosaurs in Alaska's Arctic and subarctic.
When I started this project 24 years ago, I think the number of dinosaur sites known from Alaska, you could count on one hand, maybe with a couple of extra fingers.
Fiorillo is the executive director of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science. He spent dozens of field seasons along the Aleutian Chain and on the North Slope, but he's never navigated the Yukon River or explored its banks for signs of dinosaurs.
We've got a geologic map. We know where the rocks of interest intersect with the river, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to let the geology and paleontology determine what happens while we're on the river.
Back in 2013, a team from the University of Alaska Fairbanks reported finding thousands of dinosaur tracks from at least two species somewhere along the Yukon, between the villages of Ruby and Caltag. It's unclear if anyone has been back since. And Fiorillo wants to know more about the local indigenous knowledge of the footprints.
These communities may actually have something just because they're up and down that river and those people see stuff and they've had to have seen stuff. And maybe they have an explanation for, I'm making the assumption we'll find footprints, you know, like what does it mean to them?
Yeah, just because we haven't heard it doesn't mean the story's not there.
And if these communities have those stories, and if they're willing to share them, I would love to hear them.
The rocky outcrops the team will target are from the Cretaceous, up to 100 million years old. They also hold fossilized plant material, small clues that can help the team piece together the story of the dinosaurs that once roamed Alaska's interior. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
A group of kayakers are attempting a 1,200-mile expedition through the Inside Passage this summer. The 8-man group includes 6 British military veterans. They have suffered gunshot wounds, 2 double amputations, paralysis, and PTSD from war zones including Iraq and Afghanistan. Theo Jones is the team's project manager. He's a civilian but has been inspired by the veterans on the team.
They are trying to shout from the rooftops that you don't have to be defined by disability. If they can influence the wounded veteran community, prove what is possible, and there are definitely people out there who are going to listen, 100%.
They're raising money for The Not Forgotten, a UK charity that supports veterans with disabilities. More than $170,000 have been donated so far. They originally planned to kayak the Amazon River in 2020, but then came the pandemic. After 3 postponements, the expedition was changed to the Inside Passage. Jones says taking on the treacherous waters of Southeast Alaska comes with a unique set of challenges.
The environment, you've got tide and weather, wildlife, eating outside of camp, things like that. The psychology, because the endurance of this is so long, the physical, these boats weigh so much. It takes 6 of us to lift the 2-man boats.
The team aims to travel 15 nautical miles per day on their 3-month journey, but they won't be able to finish their journey together. The start of the expedition was delayed in leaving Washington State, so just Jones and 2 others will continue paddling north to reach their final destination in Skagway by mid-August. The National Guard Armory in Kodiak was renamed to honor Daniel Harmon. Harmon was a lieutenant and a soldier from Woody Island on the Kodiak Archipelago. He was killed in action during the Vietnam War and honored with 3 Bronze Stars, one of the highest military honors. 2 were awarded with Valor, which denotes heroism in combat. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth attended the ceremony and has this story on the significance of the renaming.
It was standing room only at Kodiak's National Guard Armory to commemorate Daniel Lee Harmon, but at times you could have heard a pin drop. The ceremony was a mix of Aleutic tradition and military honor. After a memorial inside the building, attendees filed outside for a short dedication in front of the new sign that now bears Harmon's name. Major General Torrent Sachs is the commander of Alaska's National Guard. He gave remarks during the dedication.
As of today, it is the Daniel Harmon Armory. Round of applause.
Native people have served in every armed conflict in American history, and of the 42,000 Native Americans who served in the Vietnam War, nearly all of them volunteered, including Harmon. He was an Army Ranger, and he was killed in action in Vietnam in 1967. Harmon was part of the Army's long-range reconnaissance patrols, known as LRPs. Missions were dangerous. Teams of about 6 soldiers would be gone for days at a time, trekking deep into the jungle to report on enemy movement. He was just days away from R&R back in the U.S. when he volunteered for his final mission. Members of his platoon say Harmon and his team had climbed atop a tank for an extraction when it got stuck in a minefield, and they came under heavy fire. Harmon dragged 1 unconscious soldier to a nearby ditch. He was climbing back onto the tank to pull off the other when he was shot 2 in the chest. Those were Harmon's final moments. He was 21 years old. The soldier he saved, named Ron Kuhn, would survive. His son Michael Kuhn was born a couple years later and spoke at the renaming.
If he hadn't done those, what he did, saved my father's life, I wouldn't exist. I wouldn't be a father. I wouldn't be a husband, and I would be a grandfather.
Woody Island rises from the sea like a spruce-covered mound, just a skiff's ride away from the city of Kodiak. You can see whales and snow-capped mountains from its beaches. It's where Harmon grew up, one of the youngest of 9 children. Lisa Monroe is Harmon's niece. She never met her uncle, but says his presence was always there growing up.
They all hold Danny in such high regard, and he holds a special place because he was the soft-hearted one, you know. I mean, he was just always part of the conversation.
Monroe says her mother often talked about the family cabin on Woody Island and her uncle Danny. He was a skilled hunter and fisherman. Family members remember him as thoughtful, quiet, and artistic. They would also talk about how he loved animals and was almost an animal whisperer. Oftentimes, those animals would end up coming home with him.
One of the stories she told me quite repetitively was how he found an injured rabbit and he had put it in a shoebox and put it under his bed and nursed it back to health.
That's Harmon's nephew, Lauren Castillo, the son of another one of Harmon's sisters. Harmon wrote to his sister frequently from Vietnam, each letter signed in long looping cursive from her loving brother, with doodles and anecdotes from the field. In one letter, he tells her he volunteered for a reactionary force with his brigade. "Being me, I volunteered," he wrote. "I guess somebody has to do it, even if it is people or guys like me." His niece Monroe says his volunteerism is something that's never been lost on his family.
He volunteered for the service. He volunteered for Vietnam. He volunteered to join the LERPs, you know, and he volunteered for that last mission. That was Danny.
Harmon often has a feather tucked into his camo hat in photos from Vietnam and a big kiddish grin. Other soldiers called him a ghost for his abilities navigating the rugged Southeast Asian terrain. When everyone was nervous, they said he stayed calm, skills they attributed to his upbringing in Alaska. Monroe says it all comes back to Woody Island.
I consider it part of being from the island. It was everybody looked out for it, you know, each other.
It took years of advocacy from local organizations and Native elders in Kodiak for Harmon's name to be memorialized at the armory. Harmon's nephew, Castillo, says the renaming is significant from both a military perspective and as an Alaskan Native. He says his mother was ecstatic when she heard it would happen.
He was somebody that she looked up to her whole life. He feels a little bit cheated that his life was cut short. She understands his decision, but it's one of those sad memories. And the fact that he will live on in memory means a lot to her.
Harmon is buried on Woody Island at the place his family says he hoped to one day build a house. Major General Sachs told the crowd gathered at the armory ceremony that the new name marked a fresh chapter for the facility.
This place has been here since the mid-60s. I want it to be more welcoming. I want this to be a place where the community can come.
And a permanent place to gather and be inspired by his story, all together at Danny's house. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Angela Denny and Thomas Copeland in Petersburg, and Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.